Hello, all sentient beings, and welcome to Transmissions Alt Mode, where we talk about all news, comics, and media related to the... On this super special episode of Transmissions Alt Mode, Jeremy and Charles talk to the one, the only, Jim Sorensen, author of the AllSpark Almanac, Transformers Legacy, and the new book, Transformers: A Visual History. Today is Friday, December 6th, 2019, and this is episode 158 of Transmissions Alt Mode.
Welcome to Transmissions Alt Mode, the podcast that knows a single Transformer picture is worth 2,000 words. You know, because of the alt mode. I'm your host, Charles, a.k.a. Big C, and I'm joined by the excellent Transmissions team, which tonight is just Jeremy, a.k.a. Yakko.
Hey, how you doing? Let's talk Transformers. Someone has to say it.
Yeah. Daryl's not here, so it falls to us to continue on. So this is a special video podcast we're doing, and we have a special guest joining us tonight, and we're going to talk about pictures, lots and lots of pictures. So, Jeremy, I'm going to throw it to you to introduce our special guest.
All right. Our special guest is Jim Sorensen. He's listed in the promo text for the Transformers of Visual History book as Transformers archivist, and I don't think there's a better description. He's written or co-written a number of books that we've talked about, including the Transformers art books, AllSpark Almanac, the 30th anniversary collection, The Art of Prime, the Legacy Transformers packaging book, and then this one here that we're going to talk about tonight, Transformers of Visual History. So thanks, Jim, for coming on the show.
Well, thanks for inviting me. It's always fun for me to talk to fans and do these sort of podcasts.
Cool. Yeah. I mean, we've actually been wanting to have you on for a long time, and this is great. You know, this book just came out, and you know, it's a great opportunity.
Yeah, it's a good excuse.
So just to kind of get some background on you for our audience, you're around the same age as us, I would gather. So you probably got into Transformers with the first G1 waves. What was your introduction, the toys, the comics, or the cartoon?
My introduction was the commercial for the comics. Okay. So that was the thing that I first remember about the brand, was they had a 30-second commercial spot that was nominally advertising the Marvel issue number one, you know, with Optimus Prime and Prowl and Jazz and Starscream. And it was pretty amazing. And I think I was 8 when that came out, and I think everybody was talking about it and very, very excited about this new Transformers thing that was coming out.
Yeah, which is funny because GoBots had already been out.
GoBots too, especially that first pilot that they did, because the 5-part intro to the GoBots came out a year before pretty much the rest of it, because they only had the one season.
Yeah, but it just shows you what a cohesive strategy Hasbro had with the Marvel character creation and everything.
Absolutely, and they had perfected this with G.I. Joe just a few years earlier, and they really brought it home with Transformers, I think. And then they used that formula to varying degrees of success with other properties as the 80s rolled on.
Awesome.
I think G.I. Joe really prototyped it, and Transformers really perfected it.
Right, yeah. And then they just kind of ran it into the ground.
it's a good strategy, but you can't use it forever. There's only so many toys and toy brands that kids are going to be engaging with, even in the 80s when there weren't as many other distractions.
Yeah, and I think we're seeing now they're still trying to find their way with like new media and just how to keep toys relevant, like you said, with so many other distractions.
Yeah, well, I mean, the obvious strategy they're doing is sort of splitting their brand into the Transformers brand into various age categories, right? I mean, they've got their preschool brand supported by, you know, often supported by television. And then they have their, you know, their older, the stuff that we would have been in, analogous to the stuff we were interested in as a kid. And then they have their G1 and movie lines, which skew a little older.
So with these particular books that are like books about the franchise or about specific series and stuff. How did you get, how did you start writing those types of books?
Well, I had collected quite a few animation models. There was a website in the late 90s called Rockman 666. I think it's still up. I don't think it's changed in well over a decade. But they had scans of one of the Japanese laser discs. And in the liner notes of the book, they had animation models. And I didn't really know what they were. I didn't read a whole lot of Japanese. I could read the simple stuff, but nothing too in-depth. So I didn't really know what these designs were. But I knew they were really neat, and I was very much drawn to them. And I eventually figured out, okay, these are animation models. These are what they used to animate the show, so that different artists working on it could always be drawing the characters the same way, at least in theory. And Marvel Comics was using them as well. And I tracked down a Marvel Comics Bible that they would use. It had all their personalities and it had all these designs, more than they had in the Laserdisc. They had the fronts and the backs of the robots and the alt modes. So I thought, well, this is really cool. I'd love to share this with other people. And this is early 2000 or so, and IDW had just recently acquired the license. So I pitched a book of black and white animation models to IDW, and eventually they said yes. I wore them down a bit. They said no at first, but I came back. I'd been collecting original artwork. I've got some on the walls, and Don Figueroa was one of the guys that I bought several pieces from, and I asked him if he'd draw a cover for me. So he drew a cover for the book, and the second time I pitched, I had a Don cover on it. I think that grabbed some eyeballs, and they said, okay.
He was working with them at the time, probably.
Oh, yeah, yeah. He was, yeah, this would have been probably 2006 when I sold it, and the book came out about a year later. Awesome. So, and that was successful. And then they said, do you want to do a second arc? And I said, sure. And then the guys over at Cartoon Network had been using the arc books for reference. So when I met them at a convention, I introduced myself to them. I said, I wrote this book. And they said, wow, yeah, we'd love to do an animation model book, which eventually morphed into the AllSpark Almanac, which obviously, if you've read it, goes far beyond just character models. I think some of that was just that Bill and I had worked so hard on the arc books that we'd gotten into this idea that it should be a lot of work to put together these books, because we had a lot of restoration and there was no work involved with the Transformers animation model. We lived in LA at the time. So we just drove to Cartoon Network in Burbank. It was a 15-minute drive with a portable hard drive. And they said, well, what do you want? I said, well, the character models. And they're like, okay, anything else? I'm like, the story scripts. And they're like, okay, anything else? I'm like, the backgrounds. I'm like, yeah, great. Anything else? And I'm like, is there anything else? I don't know.
That's really cool.
Some sketchbooks, but yeah, we'd have to scan them in by hand. And like, well, do you want to do that? He's like, not really. I'm like, okay, we don't have to. That's fine. But awesome. One thing sort of led to another. Success breeds success. And as long as people keep buying the books, I'm happy to keep making them.
Awesome. So was that your first book, The Ark?
The Ark was the first book, yeah.
Like your first book of any type?
The first book of any type that I've written. Yeah, I've read a few.
Yeah, well, that's awesome.
Funny story. In college, one of the things I used to do to procrastinate was I'd make little guidebooks in probably MS Publisher or some other dinky mid-90s program. So I used to make little fan guide. I didn't even publish them or anything. I just made them and put them in a binder and put them on my bookshelf. So I've been at least interested in this for a while. And the other side part is, the other thing I used to do to procrastinate in college was make science fiction fonts. So I'd watch a movie and I'd freeze frame it on a VHS, because DVD wasn't really out yet, and like Predator, and I'd look at the little LCD font and I'd draw them out by hand and turn them into a font. And I did that with Transformers, and these days those fonts are everywhere.
Yeah, I think we probably have used a few of them.
Hasbro has certainly been using them. Yeah. So I mean, it's pretty much invented the Autobot and Decepticon fonts. The guys at Mainframe did Maximum Predacon. I just translated it and figured out what they said, which is fun because they were full of secret messages.
Yeah, that's awesome. So have you done any books for other franchises, or has it been strictly Transformers?
Oh, no, I've done other franchises. I've done a couple for G.I. Joe, again, character model books called the G.I. Joe Field Manual. Mm-hmm. And I did the Art of the Angry Birds movie book. So that was, that was a fun one. So I made sure that we got some Transformers Angry Birds into the visual history book, because I wanted to sort of honor the guys at Rovio.
That's awesome. My 5-year-old has like gotten me back into playing that game after like not playing it for probably a year or so, because my wife was playing the regular Angry Birds, and she was like, you know, Daddy has Angry Birds Transformers to kind of get him away from her. And so that game, it's still just, I mean, the game is what it is, but the music was just so much fun. The Vince Cola soundtrack.
Yeah, they got Vince in there. And my son loves to play the Star Wars Angry Birds. Mm-hmm. So they do well with their crossovers.
Yeah. It's definitely targeting a market that really shouldn't be using phones. On the visual history book itself, how did this particular one come together? Was this something that you pitched? I mean, I noticed that this is not with IDW. This is with Viz Media.
So I got an email out of the blue last summer, and it was Viz, and they said, you know, we're in talks with Hasbro about doing a Transformers art book, and they suggested that you might be a good person to talk to, or are you interested? And I said, well, I mean, I got to run it by my agent, but yes. So let's learn more about this project. So it was something. I don't know if it originated with Viz or if it originated with Hasbro, but it was a project that had already existed before I came on board, but in a very loose draft form. You know, that was they'd had an outline which we fiddled with a bit, but largely remained intact. But that was about as much as we had, and they might have done the initial asset dump, right before I came on board or right after, but it was right around that time. So was Hasbro sharing, just not necessarily stuff they specifically wanted to see, just what was handy and what they thought, you know, might make sense. And then from there, we, as the rubber met the road, we expanded in terms of where there were weaknesses. And I went through my archives and we spoke to fans to try and fill them out. And Hasbro had more material. They hadn't given, you know, they didn't give us everything. They just gave us what was, you know, either what was handy or you know, what a minimal digging might be able to produce. But when we had a specific character or a specific franchise, they were usually pretty good about seeing what they had, which was sometimes a lot and sometimes not very much.
Was it always envisioned as a 400-page?
You know, yeah, the page count was set. Yeah, it's. I call it my college chemistry textbook of. It's actually not my largest page count. That was the Complete AllSpark Almanac, which is around maybe 240 or so. But it's much larger than the AllSpark Almanac. It's taller and it's wider and it's, you know, heavier stock and it's hard.
It's hardcover, which adds a lot.
Yeah, I think the shipping weight on that is over 6 pounds.
Yeah, I'm happy for Amazon Prime.
I've ordered several of them, but the page count that was set before I got there.
Awesome. Were you able to reuse anything that you had, like any assets that you had from previous books?
Oh yeah, a lot of that. One of the things that I think was I was able to bring to the table. You know, I have the expertise in terms of putting the pieces in context and knowing what's important and what's interesting, but I also have a pretty robust archive from the projects I've worked on in the past and from fan contacts. So I'm pretty good about not losing pieces that I have, as long as I'm legally allowed to, you know, to save them and share them. So as long as those conditions are met, you know, quite a bit of it, you know, the stuff from animated, the character models, that all came out of my own archives, you know, many of which, or at least some of which we've seen before. And then some of it came out of my archives from projects that we'd started to talk about and then never materialized.
But it's nice that you already had some of the research done.
Yeah.
Well, I, looking through this, there were like a lot of older images that I was surprised to see, like some of the, this is one of them that I can pull up here on page 222, I believe. There's this like rough, like water, I guess it's watercolor of the Mount St. Hilary and the Ark. And I don't think that's something I'd ever seen before. And you know, where did you find images? Did this come from Hasbro or was it?
So this came from my own splunking. There was a woman out in Los Angeles who runs a furniture warehouse, and she had gone dumpster diving back in, I don't know, late 90s, presumably. And she'd pulled a bunch of office furniture out of the wreckage of the old Marvel cartoon studios when they went under. And many years later, she's going to sell a couple of filing cabinets, and there's all these binders in them full of stuff, and she has no idea what they were. And she wound up getting in touch with Chris McFeely, who's a good buddy of mine. Yeah. And, you know, he does his, the basics on Transformers series. And
one of our favorites.
Yeah, it's great, isn't it? He connected the two of us, and I wound up going out to L.A. and helping her figure out what she had and find buyers for some of it. James Etok is selling some of that now because, you know, he wound up picking up quite a bit of it. But, you know, I didn't ask for payment or anything. I just said, I want to scan this stuff in for my archives. And that was only about a year before this project. So I had these images and, you know, was kind of waiting for a good opportunity to, you know, to break them out to the public. Because one of the things I find is if you throw stuff up on the web, it's pretty ephemeral. You know, not that many people find it. You know, a few of them do, but generally it doesn't make much of an impact, and then it's sort of gone. So I'll do that if that's the only way to get material out there, but that's usually not my first instinct. So, you know, this, you know, the Ark picture and the volcano is just a beautiful splash in the context of this book. Yeah. But I feel like if you're looking at it, you know, on a phone, you know, this big, it's not that impressive.
Right. Yeah. But I mean, just here on the page, it's just, you know, a great piece of art, and you don't really expect, judging from the art style of the 80s series, you know, you don't really expect to see things like this as forming the basis of that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is, you know, pretty classic Florodieri artwork.
Right.
Yeah. He was responsible for a lot of the, most of the look and feel of the really early Transformers animated stuff, a cartoon, not Transformers animated, the franchise.
Right. Well, was there a piece that really surprised you when it showed up that, you know, something that might have been thought to be lost by Hasbro when, you know, they've gotten rid of a bunch of stuff, not realizing what it was?
The one that I was sort of proudest to be able to dig up was the Pat Lee Back to the 80s piece that he did for Wizard magazine, because that one, in terms of historical significance, there aren't many pieces that are more important than that one. Because if you cast your mind back to when this came out, which was the year 2000, you know, Transformers had been beasts for about 5 years. You know, G1 had run its course. G2 flared briefly and died. It didn't look like, you know, the brand was having a hard time finding its footing. G.I. Joe was going through much the same thing. And then they came out with Beast Wars, and it really solidified the brand. And I think, as an aside, having Beast Wars has really opened up the possibility of what Transformers as a franchise can be. You know, it does seem like we are now at the point where we do keep revisiting, you know, 84 through 86, you know, maybe a little 87 and 88, but, you know, there's a lot of 84 through 86, but at least I think Beast Wars helped break that mold and establish that, yeah, you can reinvent the franchise and it can be animated or Unicron trilogy or Prime or, you know, the new Robots in Disguise. And it did that really well. But that was the context of the year 2000. The sense in the fandom was Transformers were beasts, and beasts were what Transformers were going to be for the foreseeable future. And if there was a legacy character, it was something maybe that the fan club, the 3H, was bringing us at BotCon. It wasn't something that Hasbro so much was doing. And then Pat Lee came out with this image, which wasn't even a licensed image. You know, it was something that he did for Wizard to you know, honor the Transformers brand. And it was this new style, and it went back to the G1 stuff. And you know, in terms of the actual aesthetics, you know, it's not the most impressive image in the book. It's on page 119 if you're looking for it.
Okay.
But in terms of how it energized the fandom, it reminded the fans of what G1 was. It reminded Hasbro of what G1 could be. And when Hasbro went out to solicit a new comic book series, literally every, you know, from what I'm to understand from my contacts at Hasbro, everyone who pitched the Transformers series used this image. So Hasbro said, well, why go with DC or Marvel? Why don't we go with the guys who actually did this image? And that's how we got
Dreamworks. You guys actually seem to be fans and are interested in it.
Yeah, and obviously Dreamwave very much had its own challenges and ups and downs, but it was the first time that we'd really gone back to G1 in a mass market way. And the fact that Dreamwave was the number one selling comic for 7 months in a row, you know, six of which were G1 and one of which was the Armada comics, I think had a big impact on Hasbro's willingness to go back to legacy characters. And again, maybe the pendulum, you know, certainly some fans would argue that the pendulum has swung too much towards the legacy characters at this point. Although I would say we're still getting our non-G1 series, or at least until very recently, we've been still getting non-G1 series. So this image was hard to get. Pat didn't have it. Pat, you know, has washed his hands of Transformers. Ramil, I contacted, and he didn't, you know, I tracked him down. He didn't have it. I talked to the guys who were at Hasbro at the time, and they didn't have it. So we eventually wound up, you know, and I thought about, we avoided this, scanning in the originals, not the original, scanning in the,
like the Wizard magazines,
the actual magazines, because the quality is awful, and you get all kinds of thing artifacts, but you can just about get away with it if you use it small again. And we do it elsewhere in the book and in the video game section a bit, but, We got one of the people who was an editor at Wizard at the time, and they went through their old Hotmail account, and they were able to pull out a 200 DPI copy. So just slightly smaller than would have been ideal. If it was 300 DPI, we could have done a whole 2-page spread. But right. At 200 DPI, it could be this as big as it is, and pretty much no bigger. But big enough to be a reasonable image in the book. So I was proud that we were able to hunt it down, because it is important and it should be preserved. And yeah. Ramo was very happy to get a copy. And, you know, I sent a copy to Pat and Ramo, and they were happy to get it too. So, so now hopefully it is unlost and will not become relost.
That image was my, my computer desktop background for a while in the early 2000s. So yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, I don't think you can overstate the importance of it in terms of, you know, if you go back in time and, you know, assassinate Pat Lee as a baby, the trajectory of Transformers would be different.
Yeah, I mean, it's just that
I'm not advocating that.
That 80s revival that happened around that time would have just completely skipped Transformers.
Well, or at the very least, Transformers would have come to it later and in its form.
Yeah, so. It seems like Dreamwave was kind of hitting it right at the right time.
Yeah. No, I mean, absolutely. It's a shame they imploded, but they certainly managed to get the right product out at the right time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
I have a question about the putting all the, you know, how you choose all the art that goes into the book. I mean, just since you already did a complete book just on Transformers box art, there's so much art assets to do with, you know, over the 30, 35 year history of Transformers. So how do you pare that down into just a, you know, a 200 or 300 page book?
400 page book. But I needed every page. Every page was important. Nothing was wasted. I don't think, I hope. You know, that was the challenge. That was the core difficulty of putting together a book like this. When I was doing the ARC book, you know, it was comprehensive, or at least as comprehensive as I could make it based on the assets that I had. You know, it's all of the G1 American animation models that they did, 84 to 87. The Legacy book is comprehensive. It's pretty much all of the U.S. and Japanese box art from G1 and G2. You know, there's a few gaps, but very small. The Art of Prime, slightly less comprehensive, but nonetheless, the scope was everything Prime, everything the Prime cartoon. You know, so we wanted every character model, every character to be represented. Not every single image that we had, but everything. The All-Spark Almanac, comprehensive. So this project, very much not comprehensive. You know, in terms of other things I've done, it probably comes closest to something like, well, maybe the Art of the Angry Birds movie, where, you know, you're doing a little sampling. But of course, that was one movie that was made over the course of, you know, probably about, you know, 20, 24 months. You know, this is 5 years.
The assets were much easier to acquire.
Well, yeah, I didn't have any, you know, I went to the Rovio Studios and they showed me what they had. And if there was something, I don't think this happened, but if there was something where I said, oh, it'd be really nice to have X that you didn't give me, they'd have it. Because, you know, they were still in the movie wasn't done when I started the book. They showed me a copy and, you know, sometimes it would be finished and sometimes it would be the animatics, which was, you know, pretty neat. But, you know, this one, by its nature, was a survey. And the advantage that I had was that I was working with really talented people over at Viz. So I was working with David and Sarah, who are two editors over at Viz, to try and get our asset selection down. So I was able to draw up what the rough outline should be. So for each of the five chapters in the book, it's, you know, package art, comic book, animation, video game, and movies. And again, those were sort of more or less set in stone before I came on board the project. But I very much agree that that's a very logical way to break down, you know, like you could have, if we had the assets, we could have done one on like toy design, but, you know, we didn't. So we had a little bit of toy design in between the chapters. But within those five chapters, I had a lot of discretion in terms of what should be represented and how much space should be devoted to it. So I came up with a spreadsheet that said, okay, well, you know, we're going to give them, let's say 100 pages to our packaging art, and we're going to have 12 pages of G1 and 6 pages of Japanese and 2 pages of G2, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, I kept fiddling with it until all the numbers added up to 408. That was our pages. And then we went back, and with those blocks of space in mind, Sarah and David and I went through the pieces we had, and we broke them up into four rough categories, which were must-have, which were relatively few and far between. But those are images like the back to the 80s, where it's like, no, this must be in the book, and it must be relatively prominent. Probably have, which we were probably a little bit ambitious with, but those are the pieces we said, yeah, this is probably what should be roughly in the chapter, but, you know, it's okay to lose it if we must. And then we had maybe, and this was specifically if a section came in small somehow, then the designer could pull from the maybe pile. And then the rest of it was, you know, no, we don't like this piece, or we don't want this piece for whatever reason. It's just not singing to one of us. And we had roughly 5,000 pieces that we were going through. So, you know, we were pretty liberal with the notes. You know, if any one of us hated a piece, we pretty much X'd it out, because there were just so many other pieces that all three of us liked that there was right. No reason to sort of have a battle over it. The only exception would be if there was a piece that was important, but one of the editors didn't like, you know, then I might override it and say, yeah, no, I get that this maybe isn't the prettiest piece, but we actually do need to have the issue number one of Marvel, because it's extremely important. And
it's a historical reason.
Yeah, exactly. Again, I think we were a little ambitious with the maybes and the probablys, but we wound up using very, very few maybes, because very few sections came in light. Many sections came in heavy, but we sort of left it up to our designer. So once we said, okay, there are, you know, 12 pages devoted to G1 packaging art, and they should be roughly in order, you could pick which ones you want. So, you know, we have a few guys from 84 and a few guys from 85 and so on and so forth. But the designer got to pick which 84 guys that we had flagged as probably keep. So there were at least four main voices choosing which pieces to do. And we did pay, we were trying to balance the historical importance with the aesthetic importance, with just how the page is laid out. You know, like even a very nice piece might not work in the context of that section. If it's, you know, if it's too green and the whole rest of the section's purple, it might just not be visually appealing.
And notice you have the classic, you know, G1 battle art in the box is kind of outside of all the sections. So is that a way to kind of keep it in without taking away from the page count?
Or did that count? We knew that we had a few extra pages to play with. So when there were pieces that we really liked that didn't necessarily make it into the appropriate section, we kept them in mind when we were putting together the intros and the outros. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like on page six, we've got Solus Prime, and that was something Ken specifically requested, because I wanted the piece opposite Ken's intro to the book. You know, he wrote a pretty great foreword. I wanted that one of his pieces to be opposite that, so I let him pick. And then, you know, I picked the Cybertron to go opposite mine, because I thought, A, the Unicron trilogy was a bit underrepresented. B, it's Primus, it's Cybertron. I mean, that's a pretty important character. You know, it's a neat piece. So I had a lot of input there. And again, yeah, the classic G1 box art. We didn't want the packaging section to be too long, and we didn't want it to be too G1. So, you know, there's 35 years of history. So we really wanted to survey as much of it as we could. But, you know, we couldn't not have this piece in the book either.
Right. So let me go through some of this other stuff that I have on the, I can show. Because like you said, you did get a big mix of stuff. One of the things here is you have a lot of the current stuff from like the current War for Cybertron trilogy. Like I have here a picture of the Starscream in his Cybertronian mode and the robot mode. Did Hasbro kind of push for some of these more recent stuff over some of the older?
I wouldn't say over some of the older. I would say Hasbro had a few pieces they were very proud of and they were interested in showcasing. The Band of Brothers piece that they did that we used towards the beginning of the package art section was one of those. And, you know, the Omega Supreme art was one they were really proud of. The Starscream one's actually one that I fought for. And that came about because Hasbro had asked that we expand the Siege section by two pages. And we had lost, I don't remember why, but we'd lost a couple of pages elsewhere in the book. So we had a few pages to play with. And I had gone through, you know, one of the very, very late versions of the book, maybe version 5.0 or something. And I had noticed that we were a little lighter on Starscream spreads than I wanted. We had plenty of Optimus spreads, plenty of Megatron spreads, you know, a few Shockwave, and we have a Bludgeon in there and a Hotshot in there. You know, we had a lot of them, but for Starscream at the time, the only one we had was Prime Starscream.
Yeah. And you need to appease the Starscream fan base.
I wanted a nice full Star. You know, I wanted Starscream and Grimlock and Soundwave to be represented, you know, with full page spreads in the book. We have 408 pages. There should be room for it. And it just happened to work out that Starscream was light. So so we didn't have the Starscream box art, the robot mode box art at the time. We had the vehicle mode. And I said, this was really late in the process. So we were trying very hard not to go back to Hasbro and say, give us more art. But I said, no, this one is actually worth fighting for. You know, let's try and get the Starscream. And I mocked up a page, you know, with just like a picture of the box, but I cropped it and said, This is what I think the page should look like. I think it'll be really slick. Unfortunately, Hasbro agreed. So, you know, we got this Starscream robot mode and vehicle mode. And around the same time, we'd been fiddling with the Legends section. So I got an extra Starscream full page spread of the King Starscream in the Legends section of the video game part of the book. So yeah, that made me happy as well. So we solved the Starscream problem. Four full page spreads feels like, you know, just fine for Starscream.
Right.
But I don't think there was very little that Hasbro didn't like or didn't want in the book. There were things that they were keen to feature, but I think that's None of the pieces they were keen on were ones where I looked at and said, I don't like that. You know, they were all very strong pieces of artwork in and of themselves.
Yeah. What about some of the comic ones? Like I have here the, I'm not sure what page this was from, but, the game over Optimus Prime gets, you know,
That was all me.
Yeah. So were you the primary on some of these older comic pages?
Yeah. I mean, mostly, yeah. The just before that, on 124, 125, there's a 2-page spread of Shockwave walking through a bunch of Autobot corpses, and that was actually one my editor was very keen on. It actually started as an accident. Like the notes were that this should have been half of one page, so like the bottom of the previous page, and it had come back as a full page, and the editor just fell in love with it. So that was sort of, but largely it was. I got to lay out which images were important here. The upper left of 126 was a very late addition. I think we'd had a circuit breakers page in there, and then and we thought we could get it to clear legal, and then it didn't. So that one wound up in there sort of very late in the game. But mostly I got to pick stuff I liked. I wanted a Bob Budiansky cover. So that's why we had the Assault of the Savage Seacons on 129 opposite the Optimus Prime video game. Video game Optimus was all mine. I wanted to get one of the Jim Lee covers in there. I wanted to get, obviously, a good representation of Andrew Wildman and Jeff Senior. So, and actually the comic section's one where I kind of wish I had just two more pages, because I would have loved to have gotten a Jose Delbo piece in there. I would have really liked to get the Mark Texiera cover in there, but you know, we just ran out of room with what we were able to do. So
yeah, and you have a good representation from the Marvel UK as well.
Yeah, that was important to me that we have a few of those, because
especially the art style was just so different from the US.
Yeah, and I wanted to showcase some of that, and they have some great interior. I love 133, which is all first pages. And you know, Target 2006 and Meltdown and Grudge Match and Fallen Angel, and I like that one on 132 because it's just so weirdly structured. You know, there's so much white space, but it's from the very first, you know, UK completely exclusive story arc. And I didn't want to do Man of Iron because that's sort of a weird outlier. It was in both places, but you know, this was from Furman's first story, and I said, yeah, no, I this is one of those ones where the editor's like, oh, I don't like this piece. I'm like, no, you're not supposed to. It's supposed to be weird and they're off model, and that's the point, you know, that's what I'm showing.
Going down to some of the other comic stuff I have here on page 170, you have nice sketches and then like kind of the final inks of a Nick Roach piece. And I love that you're showing just the stages that a comic page kind of goes through. You know, so many people don't understand the multi-step process that comics go through. So, you know, I always like seeing the rough sketches.
Yeah, we tried to do that at least a little bit. I think there's a Windblade later where we have the inks and then the colors. So, you know, and I think we did that with one of the Armada package art as well. So, yeah, we did that a few times. You know, we again, only 400 pages. There's only so many times you could do it, but it was something that we wanted to showcase, to look at the process and just kind of appreciate, you know, how neat the rough sketch is and how close to what we finally got it is too.
Yeah. And I see in here, like later on, you have like that on the animation stuff, you have some of the pages with the animation models. Were those some of your original like collection that you had been able to reuse?
Some of them, yeah. Actually, so like 227, there's a bunch of animation models that have the handwritten notes. Those all actually came from Hasbro. But the Orion Pax and Alita 1, which I managed to dig up, that was out of my collection. And then I kind of focused in animation models on stuff that hadn't necessarily seen the light of day before. So if you look on 229, that was my nod to season 3, which we were a little light on, but you know, there were a bunch of season 3 models that I didn't have when I was putting together, or mostly didn't have when I was putting together the arc books, and I thought they were all, you know, pretty neat characters or designs. You know, that weird sentry bot in the bottom.
In terms of looking at all these different art styles for Transformers, I mean, you've got a lot of different media, a lot of different art styles. What stands out as like some of your favorites or some of your preferences, and, you know, from comics, TV, box art, everything. So what really catches your eye?
Oh, that's a tough question. You know, I grew up as a G1 guy. So to me, the G1 airbrushed packaging art is always something that's pretty close to my heart. I mean, there's a reason that we did Legacy. I mean, obviously there was demand for it, but it was a lot of work to find those pieces and restore them and track them all down and have as few gaps as we did. But that was very much a labor of love. So I can sort of look at that sort of stuff all day. So that's pretty high up there. You know, the character designs, you know, that show up in animation models. What I like about them is the simplicity. And, you know, we see that at various places through the animation chapter. You know, we have them for some of the Japanese series, you know, the Beast Wars 2 and Beast Wars Neo. We avoided it for animated because we'd already published all those in the AllSpark Almanac. But, you know, we see the Prime models and the Rescue Bots and some of the Robots in Disguise models and Cyberverse. And, you know, I like artwork that's referential as opposed to dynamic. You know, I like art. I mean, I like dynamic art too, obviously, but I like art that's designed to showcase what you're looking at as opposed to, you know, maybe telling a story. So it's nice for me to be able to see some of that and feature some of that. I really like the homage section of the book. It was one of those in-between chapters. I think that was, let's see, where was that? I think that was in between comics and TV. Is that right? There we go. Yeah, and that was fun because it's interesting. It's on page 204 through 209. But it's interesting how often Transformers either goes back and references itself or how often Transformers references some other work. You know, we start out with the popular culture, you know, the Toxic Avenger or yeah. Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. Or, yeah. I
think we're all familiar with that. Pepper one.
Classic images. And then, you know, they get recreated by Casey or by Nick. And those are some really neat pieces. But then if you go to the next page on 208, 209, it's all Transformers doing classic comic covers. You know, the Justice League or the X-Men Giant Size number one or the Killing Joke. And my favorite get here, and that's why it's so big, was Liefeld doing Liefeld. You know, the number 87 as imagined by Rob Liefeld himself as a Transformers cover. And then the last page, you know, 210, 211, it's just, you know, Transformers going back and sort of doing the same thing again. You know, the there's your Angry Birds image. It's the Angry Birds version of the Sony movie cover. But, you know, you also have the classic movie or the Marvel G1 number one or Marvel G1 number five. You know, all stuff that shows up in the book, or that classic Guido Guidi Predaking piece that gets recreated as the Power of the Primes Predaking, or just the you know, going back to the Transformers the movie for
the Lost Light.
Yeah, that was for the Machinima series. Those were promotional pieces for Combiner Wars. So I like all of those. Every one of those pieces is sort of a delight to me to find and to see and appreciate. And I kind of like, you know, juxtaposing them so they're all together, so you can kind of see that this is something that Transformers does do, you know, with some regularity.
Yeah, I do think it's funny that you get these homages to these comic covers. And when we commissioned a cover a few years ago for Till All Are One number one, they specifically told us we couldn't do that. So I mean, like we had, you know, Alex Mill and Josh Perez doing the art, and they still, like, our original one I think was gonna mimic like what an X-Men cover.
It was a Days of Future Past, the Days of Future Past cover.
Wanted posters?
Yeah. They said we couldn't do that. So we could homage a Transformers comic, but nothing outside of that, which was fine. We did Transformers 18, and it was great.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. I think I've seen that one.
So. Yeah. So.
Yeah. So just one additional question. So now that you've done all this research and kind of added to your archive, is this something you give back to Hasbro? Like, does Hasbro ask for like a copy of your archive from all the research on the book so that they can kind of preserve it for posterity?
Well, you know, everything in the book Hasbro has.
Right. Okay.
You know, sort of by definition, right? You know, they have all the high resolution files in the book. You know, they haven't ever at any point come to me and say, you know, we want everything you have. But what does happen, not frequently, but you know, once every few years, someone at Hasbro comes to me and says, "Oh, I'm looking for X. Do you have it?" And you know, if I have it, I'm always happy to share it with them. And if I don't, you know, I'm usually at least able to, you know, say, "I don't think that exists anymore," or "I don't have it, but you might consider talking, you know, to someone else because, you know, they, you know, this guy might have it, you know, here's his email." So,
yeah,
okay. Sometimes they might not give it to me, but they might give it to Hasbro.
Yeah. Well, that's cool that, you know, you are able to help even if you don't have it.
Well, as much as I can.
All right. Well, you know, before we wrap up, I will say that this book comes in a deluxe edition, which is the version I have, and I showed off on our podcast a few weeks ago. It comes with this this case for it, and it also comes with some prints, and I have a few of them here that are still in the envelope. The Bumblebee movie. I really love the Fall of Cybertron.
That's a nice part. One.
And then you have. Was this the Band of Brothers?
Oh, the Band of Brothers.
Talking about? I have that, and then I've actually this weekend framed a couple, my two favorite ones.
Oh, you did in the Marvel number 5, huh? And the Japanese movie poster?
Yeah, so I did the Marvel number 5, which showing them in the frames is always problematic. But and then, yeah, the Japanese movie poster.
You have a bit of glare, but I got to say, they look beautiful.
Yeah. And I love just, you know, the size and the quality of the prints are really great. So well, did you have a hand in picking those?
I did. That one, you know, some parts I get a lot of input in, some parts I get, you know, not as much. But the prints, so the process of putting together the prints were we all agreed, we knew it was going to be 5 prints. We all thought it should be one from each section of the book. Mm-hmm. So with that in mind, I put together a short list of, you know, 2 to 5 pieces per section that I thought would show it off well. And I tried to get a nice mix of G1 and later years stuff. So it wasn't, you know, it wasn't all, you know, a G1 piece of box art and a G1 piece of comic art, et cetera. You know, we wanted to sort of mix that up. And we also wanted to make sure it wasn't all, you know, like 5 pieces, all of which are, you know, variations of Optimus Prime looking heroic.
Right.
So we, and then again, collectively, we sort of went through and whittled down and said, okay, well, I like this piece best. I like this piece. And once we did that, you know, there was, you know, we looked and said, oh no, we still have too much Optimus. Let's swap out one of those. And, you know, but I think it came together pretty nicely. You know, the video game section was probably the easiest just because there weren't that many representative pieces in the video game section that were really beautiful. You know, partially because video games more than any of the other mediums have evolved so much.
Yeah.
So, you know, the Transformers games from the 80s, they make sense to be in the book. They wouldn't necessarily make sense to be framed as a poster. You know, the rest of them, I think it all came together pretty nicely. We achieved the goal, I think. You know, we've got, you know, the more modern package art, you know, obviously the movie, we had a lot of good choices for the movie, but we all really liked the Bumblebee, and that was sort of the newest, shiniest thing there. So we wanted to show that off. And, but yeah, no, I'm very pleased with the selection of prints. I think the deluxe version came out pretty well. You know, that slipcase is not just a nice piece of protection, but it also just looks really elegant and classy with the two embossed symbols.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that. I mean, frankly, I like that better than the Movieverse Prime and Megatron. I mean, this does look really, really nice. So
yeah, I mean, it's really simple, but sometimes that works really well.
You can get this where Amazon, pretty much any big bookseller like Barnes & Noble.
Sure. And your local comic store would probably be happy to order it for you.
Cool. Yeah. So I guess before we let you go, and we will have links like to Amazon and stuff to for people to buy it in our show notes. But we, with everyone we have on the show, we run them through some rapid fire questions just to kind of get a sense of who they are. Just kind of like quick answer. So if you don't mind, you'd like to run through those.
All right, let's do it.
All right. So first, Autobot or Decepticon?
Decepticon.
Okay, who's your favorite Decepticon?
Shockwave.
All right. Cool. Live action movie, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, or Bumblebee?
5.
Oh, wow.
When we're done with the rapid fire.
Okay, cool. On the comics, More Than Meets the Eye / Lost Light, Robots in the Sky / Optimus Prime to All or One, or the new ongoing or the new Galaxy series?
Lost Light.
Third party toys, yes or no?
No.
Cats or dogs?
Cats.
Coffee or tea?
Tea. I'm drinking it right now.
Chicken or steak?
Steak.
Pepsi or Coke?
Coke.
Burger King or McDonald's?
Neither.
Or do you have a particular fast food you like?
I don't really do fast food.
Try to stay away. Okay. History or science?
Science.
Xbox, PlayStation, Switch, or
Switch.
Other gaming console? Switch. Okay. PC or Mac?
PC.
iPhone or Android?
Android.
What phone app can you not live without?
I'm on Facebook an awful lot.
All right. Marvel or DC?
Marvel.
Who's your favorite Marvel character?
I'd say the X-Men as a team are my favorite Marvel book, if that answers your question.
Okay. Stallone or Schwarzenegger?
Schwarzenegger.
And Pixar or DreamWorks?
Pixar.
What is a guilty pleasure movie that you always will stop to watch whenever you're like channel surfing?
Scott Pilgrim versus the World. Okay. I don't know if it's a guilty pleasure, but I can't turn away from it.
Well, that's kind of the what.
Yeah, that I thought that was the thrust of it.
Yeah. Star Wars or Star Trek?
Star Wars.
Okay. Simpsons, Family Guy, or Rick and Morty?
Rick and Morty.
Walking Dead or Game of Thrones?
Ugh.
Or neither.
Can I go with neither? I've watched both, but.
NFL
start off really strong.
Yeah. Well, we probably need to update that question for more current series now that, you know, Game of Thrones is gone.
Better Call Saul.
There you go. NFL, MLB, NHL, UFC, or NBA?
I'm not a sports guy.
Okay. Porsche, Ferrari, Lamborghini, or Volkswagen Beetle?
Lamborghini.
And blonde, brunette, or redhead?
Brunette.
Okay, cool. And that is all the rapid fire. Thanks for
that. All right. How did I do? Did I get it right?
Every answer you gave is right. All right, well.
So Transformers 5.
Yeah.
It's not the best one.
No.
Don't watch the movies for the best one. What I enjoy about the movies is I enjoy strip mining them for ideas, because to me, it's very obvious that once you get past one that had a certain level of discipline imposed on it, presumably by sort of the Spielbergian influence.
And a plot.
But it had a plot. It had a linear plot that you could follow. You know, the further you get beyond that, the more it's like people throwing spaghetti at the wall to see what sticks. And that's what I like about the movie franchise. I like that it's so willing to explore different ideas and concepts that you don't get in other parts. I mean, other parts of Transformers do tend to be a little rigid. I mean, even IDW, which is very much willing to go beyond the binary of a war is still very conventional storytelling in a way. So I like the idea that, you know, they're willing to say, well, no, it's World War II guys and also Arthurian knights and also an alien and maybe Earth is I like that all those, I don't want to say comfortably coexist, because they obviously there's a tension between all those ideas, but I like being able to go in and pull out the one that I think is interesting, like the claw in Forever is a long time coming, reaching in and pulling in A3. Like that's what I like about it. So.
Yeah. I guess on the bright side, that those are ideas that then Hasbro can go on and later on decide to say, hey, IDW, make an Arthurian Transformers series.
Yeah, well, and yeah, I think you can see my own interest kind of peeking out in the context of the book, because we get to, I devoted relatively a lot of pages to the Last Knight. That's mm-hmm. right. Because there's so much of it and so much that doesn't necessarily make it into the movie even. But right. I like being able to see some of these ideas, the HMS Victory and early canopy designs and the early depth charge designs and all that stuff. So yeah, that's my answer. I mean, obviously Bumblebee is the best story of right. them. But I'm not watching it for the story.
Yeah, that makes sense though. I mean, you have an ulterior motive.
Yeah.
You're like, what can I put in the book?
Well, not necessarily the book, but what from it can I take as a fan or as a creator?
Yeah.
Awesome. But yeah, there you go.
Well, how can people find you online if they want to, to talk to you about your books or any other thing?
Well, I'm pretty easy to find. I'm good at snagging domains. So I'm Jim Sorensen on Twitter, and I'm Jim Sorensen on Facebook. No underscores or anything. So that makes it pretty easy. Or you can always email me at transformerstheark@yahoo.com. We made that after we got our first book.
Yeah, I noticed that's actually in the last page of the book. I'm like, that's
great.
Yeah,
usually do that. Yeah. Well, I like to hear from people. So, the feedback is one of the most gratifying things about it. You realize making a book is sort of a lonely task. You know, you go into a room and you lock yourself in a room for 9 months and then you're done and you have a book. And after you're done, 5 months pass where there's nothing and you're in the cave. And then finally the book comes out, and then, you know, it comes out on the same day as The Mandalorian. And then that's what everyone's talking about. So,
yeah, well, I mean,
I don't blame them.
If there was a way to get Baby Yoda in the book, if you had known about that.
Yeah, I'd love to do a Star Wars book. So I've got all the animation models from Droids. Unfortunately, I don't think Disney is very keen. They're beautiful designs. But
yeah. Well, yeah. Well, I mean, maybe stuff like this, you will get an end, because, you know, there are people at Lucasfilm like Pablo Hidalgo that are big Transformer guys.
Pablo is great, actually. You know, he did the Transformers The Vault. And, you know, we chatted when that came out. So, you know, we're mutual fans. So you never know.
Yeah. Well, good luck with that. And thanks for spending some time with us. And
it's always a pleasure.
Great. And right. I guess for Charles, who had to step away, thanks again. And we will talk to everyone later on Altmode.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening to this episode of Transmissions. But just because this episode is over doesn't mean the Transformers fun has to stop. Join us and other Transformers fans on our Discord chat server by visiting transmissionspodcast.com/Discord. If you would like to learn more about how you could support the Transmissions Podcast, just visit transmissionspodcast.com/support. Thank you all for listening, and we'll see you again next week.